Jesus rose from the dead as the first fruits of the new creation. What God did for Christ in raising Christ from the dead, he will do for the whole world. A new heavens, a renewed earth. In other words, 2,000 years ago, what was there, Christ as resurrected, was a little piece of the renewed world. There, inserted into this age. And if Christ, Paul just said in the reading from 1 Corinthians 15, if Christ wasn't raised, then our faith is futile, we're still dead in our sins, the Christian hope is nullified. So what I want to share with you today is information that's been very important on my own personal journey. When I was a young adult, I had big questions about the Christian faith. Is this something that's anchored in history, or is this just a puff of ideas? And so what I want to share with you today isn't everything there is about the resurrection. What I want to share with you is the evidence for the resurrection, the historical information and background for the resurrection that was very, very important for me as a young adult. And was reading this kind of material and understanding something of the history surrounding the resurrection, that there's real people and real timelines and real people groups involved. They're embedded in the first century Roman Empire. That strengthened my faith immeasurably. And I'm thinking that if this is the stuff that strengthened my faith when I was 18 and 19, that maybe there's some teenagers and some young adults and some middle-aged people and some seniors here for whom it will be significant as well. So then, evidence for the resurrection. Not everything there is to say about the resurrection by any means, but those historical pieces of evidence that were very important for me as a young adult. Before we start, two books once again. There's a bookstore open after the service, and it will be for the whole series. The Case for Christ is a book that I'm leaning on very heavily today, and I'll be quoting from Lee Strobel a lot. It's an excellent book, and The Reason for God by Tim Keller is a great book as well. $10 and $20. And The Case for Christ, we've got one for teenagers and also one for kids out there, as well as some other books. So I recommend that you check out the bookstore as we go. Well, let's make a start then. Gary Habermas, who's a New Testament scholar and believes in the resurrection, says this is very helpful. He says, first, did Jesus die on the cross? And second, did he appear later to people? If you can establish these two things, you've made your case. Because dead people don't normally do that. That's Gary Habermas, a New Testament scholar. So we're going to follow Gary Habermas' advice and talk about Jesus' death, first of all, and then his appearances. And that's going to be our track. So first of all, the question, did Jesus really die? And look, it is relevant. The Quran, the scriptures of Islam, 7th century document in 600 ADs, says that Jesus didn't die, he passed out, but he was revived, and then he fled to India. And today in India, there's a shrine that supposedly marks where he was buried in Kashmir, kind of on the nexus between India and Pakistan. But the fact is, friends, the Romans were expert killers. They were really good at it. And a Roman soldier who was charged with executing someone, if that person escaped, that Roman soldier would be killed. We know that. And it wasn't just Jesus' crucifixion either. It started with a flogging, and Roman floggings could kill a person even before they were crucified. Some people didn't make it to the cross because they were flogged so first. And the flesh that came off someone could go straight down to the bone. Even apart from a crucifixion, Jesus was flogged almost to death. And the crucifixion, as you know, the torture was excruciating. Both of Jesus' shoulders would have been dislocated. And so where Dr. Alexander Metherell says this about Jesus' condition after his flogging and execution, he says, even if he did somehow revive, a person in that kind of pathetic condition would never have inspired his disciples to go out and proclaim that he's the Lord of life who triumphed over the grave. But certainly it's one in a billion that he would have survived a Roman crucifixion. So we can take it that Jesus did die and he didn't flee to India. And so now, did Jesus appear to his disciples? Is the question that we'll spend our time in for the rest of this morning. And we're just going to get into this question slowly. So just be patient as we kind of unfold the evidence, if you would. And what I'm trying to do is, I'm trying to anchor it in history. But it's going to take a few minutes. And of course, this is all on the back of some of the stuff concerning the gospel records that we looked at last week. So if you take out your Bibles, what we're going to do now is we're going to begin by reading the gospel records, Matthew, Mark and Luke, but it's also in John. And New Testament professor and philosopher William Lane Craig, he says this, it's on the screen there. He says, in the gospel records, we have multiple independent attestation of the empty tomb story. We have multiple independent attestation of the empty tomb story. And I'll just say too, before we get into Matthew, that critics, and there's plenty of them, have attacked the resurrection on the grounds of the discrepancy between Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. So we'll sit with that now as we look at the gospel records. Well, let's first of all go to Matthew 28. Matthew 28, the first account of the resurrection as we have it in the order of the New Testament documents, Matthew 28, verse 1 to 4, last chapter of Matthew. So just watch these details, if you would. We're not going to read the whole story, just four verses. After the Sabbath, at dawn, note that, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and, going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance, the angel's appearance, was like lightning and his clothes were as white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. So we just note from there that it happened at dawn. Note that an angel rolled back the stone and there was an earthquake. Okay, let's flip on to Matthew's account now, Mark's account now in Mark 16, last chapter of Mark. And we'll read 1 to 5 of Mark 16. And we'll notice similarities and some secondary details that are different. Mark 16, 1 to 5. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Salome, three people bought spices so that they might go and anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb and they asked each other, "Who will roll away the stone from the entrance to the tomb?" But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. And now notice verse 5, as they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. In dialogue with me, have had a and tried to make a lot of it. So this is very, very interesting. This is very interesting. And let's discuss this for a moment. First of all, there's a historical core here that's reliable and can be depended upon. For an ancient source 2,000 years ago, this is actually remarkable correspondence. I spend a lot of my time in ancient history because I'm doing a PhD on the Old Testament, not just biblical history, but Assyrian and Babylonian documents. And for an ancient source, this is remarkable correspondence. And William Lane Craig, who had that quote up there on the screen, he speaks about the accounts of history and what is believable and what is reliable. And William Lane Craig says, for example, we have two accounts of Hannibal crossing the Alps to attack Rome. They're incompatible and irreconcilable, yet no classical historian doubts the fact that Hannibal did mount such a campaign. Further, sometimes, of course, a bit of discrepancy actually strengthens the case. And Lee Strobel in his book says so, he puts it very well. Lee Strobel was a crime journalist, so he covered crime trials, often murder trials. And he writes, sometimes while covering criminal trials, I've seen two witnesses give the exact same testimony down to the nitty-gritty details, only to find themselves ripped apart by the defense attorney for having colluded before the trial. And then Strobel says, if all four Gospels were identical in their minutiae, That would have raised a suspicion of plagiarism. So it's very interesting, and it takes us back to that original quote by William Lane Craig, that we have multiple and independent attestation of the empty tomb story. Multiple and independent attestation. So that's very important as we start to think about the resurrection as a historical event that affected people who had witnessed it and then who wrote about it. And it's history that we're concerned about. Here's the next thing that I'd like to speak about. I'd like to speak in more detail about the appearances. And, goodness. It's very interesting, as I was rereading this book, to track Lee Strobel's own process from being a convinced atheist. Because a lot of New Testament scholars today are convinced atheists and don't believe in the resurrection. It's a funny thing to say, but it's true. So there's a lot of ink spilled over the resurrection. And Lee Strobel said that as an atheist, he decided that the resurrection was a legend, a tall tale that grew up in the church and grew and grew. But what was very, very significant as a journalist who was then exploring the resurrection to go to 1 Corinthians 15. So let's just go there now because it has been a very significant text for me as well as I explored it as a young adult. And this is a text that Sam just read out. And I'll say as you open it up that New Testament scholars have agreed that this is actually, it's a creed that predates Paul's letter to the Corinthians. So can you see 1 Corinthians 15 there? 1 to 8 we're going to read. And this section predates the whole letter. And if you just look at verse 3, we can see it's a creed because Paul writes, "What I received, I passed on to you as of first importance." And that's rabbinic technical terminology for an oral tradition that's passed on. So Paul's passed this on to the Corinthians already before he writes this. Now let's read this creed from verse 1. "Now, brothers, I want to remind you the gospel I preached to you, which you have received and on which you've taken your stand. By this gospel you are saved if you hold firmly to the word I preached to you, otherwise you've believed in vain. For what I received I passed on to you of first importance." Now here's our creed from verse 3. It's very old. "That Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures. That he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures." So you can, it reads like a creed, doesn't it? It reads like something that's been repeated thousands of times. Verse 5, the appearances. "Then he appeared to Peter, then to the 12. After that he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all he appeared to me also as to one abnormally born." And probably verse 8 isn't in the creed. So now, if you can just look at this timeline I've got up here. The death of Christ, 30 AD probably. Go to the top of the timeline, 55 to 57 AD, that's when we know Paul wrote the letter to 1 Corinthians. And that's generally accepted in the scholarly community, Christian or not. Now, Paul says in verse 3 that he'd already passed on the creed. And so he must have passed on the creed on his first visit to Corinth in 51 AD. Can you see the history here? He wrote about the creed in 55 AD, 1 Corinthians. But he told them the creed in 51 AD. Now, this is what's interesting. The creed is an early church testimony, oral testimony to the resurrection appearances. And it's already there only 20 years after the resurrection of Christ. And a lot of scholars think, actually, that Paul himself first heard the creed from the apostles in the 30s, between 32 and 38 AD. So this is very, very significant, the existence of this creed to do with Christ's resurrection appearances. And you can see the significance in this, that you can't have a creed going round saying Christ appeared to all these people just a few years after Christ died if he didn't actually appear to these people. Just have a look again at verse 5. He appeared to Peter, then to the 12, but look at verse 6. After that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers. And that creed is easily shown to be nonsensical if Christ didn't appear to 500 of the brothers. Yet we know this is a creed that is right at the center of this historical Christ-believing community. And so Gary Habermas, who we started by quoting this morning, said this, "Now stop and think about it. You would never include this phrase unless you are absolutely confident that these folks would confirm that they really did see Jesus alive." And then Habermas continues, "I mean, Paul was virtually inviting people to check it out for themselves. He wouldn't have said this if he didn't know they'd back it up." And then Habermas says this elsewhere. He says, "Here are the names of specific individuals and groups of people who saw Christ, written at a time when people could still check them out if they wanted confirmation." And the point is that this is easily falsified. So can you get a sense now of the history of the tradition? And Mark's gospel itself was written in the 50s AD, soon after between 20 and 30 years after Christ's resurrection. So it really is embedded, these traditions, in the early church community who knew Christ alive and also risen. Well, let's go on to another point now. This is very significant. The transformation of Jesus' followers. And this is very, very significant in the scholarship right now. So consider the disciples' own emotional process with Jesus' arrest and crucifixion. You know, you'll recall that even just at Jesus' arrest, let alone his crucifixion, the disciples fled. They disbanded. And we know that after Jesus was crucified, the disciples were discouraged and oppressed. Now let's just see this. Just quickly fly to Luke 24. Just so you can see it for yourself. It's quite powerful. And it's very important in the scholarship. Luke 24, from 20 to 21, this is just one example. And this is Luke 24, 20 to 21. And it's the road to Emmaus. You remember some of Jesus' followers were walking on the road to Emmaus, and Jesus appears to them. So right now, the apostles are talking to Jesus, risen. So Luke 24, 20, and they say to Jesus, risen, "The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him." Then they say, "But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel." We had hoped he was the one who was going to redeem Israel, but that hope is dead. And upon encountering Christ, this is the thing, that the disciples became mobilized into the mission of Christ. They became energized to be leaders of the early church, to be leaders with such seriousness and fervor that the gospel spread to the corners of the Roman Empire. These disciples went from discouraged and depressed to being transformed into people of seriousness and fervor. And in fact, after 3 centuries, the whole Roman Empire itself would become Christian, as the historians here know. And the transformation in Jesus' followers from being depressed to being mobilized was so great that most of these early followers were willing to be executed in torturous ways. And this transformation of Jesus' followers needs explanation. With Jesus' crucifixion, his followers knew that the kingdom is not coming. Their transformation is due to their encountering the risen Christ. And it's very important to note the weight of this. This is very difficult to get around. I'll say more about this in a minute. But the idea that the disciples stole the body and faked a resurrection used to be said 100 years ago. But in the scholarship now, that's not even suggested. Because of the historical reality of the leadership of the disciples. That's a historical reality. And so skeptical scholars, and there's thousands of them in North America, can no longer offer that the disciples stole a body, because it doesn't make sense. of what we see in these transformed men and women. I just note in passing, we add to this the evidence of the transformation of skeptics, and we think of the Apostle Paul, who wrote the letter to the Corinthians, first of all, who was persecuting the Christians in Acts 7 and 8, and he becomes the apostle par excellence. And we also note James, a brother of Jesus, who we learn in Mark chapter 3, thinks that Jesus, his brother, is insane, literally. Now, if Christ, his brother, is then crucified, that's not the kind of transformation that we need to see in James that's going to explain how he became the leader of the church in Jerusalem. Now, let me pause here to make a complex point. On the other hand, you could say, but there are other religions that people die for. And there are other religions where there are people who are zealous for it. So why doesn't the argument cut both ways? Why isn't the argument just as powerful for Islam, for example? And there's a very important point to be made about that. That there's a difference here. Because these apostles claimed that they saw, personally, they saw Jesus resurrected. Now those who followed those who followed Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad of Islam, they never saw the revelations that were given to Muhammad. They just believed Muhammad's testimony. They could choose to believe it or not to believe it, and they chose, many of them, to believe it. But when it comes to Christ's resurrection, they're claiming to see Christ's resurrection. And if they're lying, it means they didn't see Christ's resurrection. And then you can't explain the mobilization of the church. Do you know what I'm saying? What I'm saying is that what the apostles' testimony could be falsified in a way that the followers of Muhammad's couldn't. Because the apostles of Jesus either saw him or they didn't. And Lee Strobel says like this. He says, people will die for their religious beliefs if they sincerely believe they're true. But people won't die for their religious beliefs if they know their beliefs are false. While most people can only have faith that their beliefs are true, the disciples were in a position to know without a doubt whether or not Jesus had risen from the dead. They claimed that they saw him and talked with him and ate with them. If they weren't absolutely certain, they wouldn't have allowed themselves to be tortured to death for proclaiming the resurrection had happened. Do you see the point? Well, let me just briefly speak about three other explanations that are offered for the resurrection, alternative explanations that try to be ways around the resurrection of Christ. One old one is, as I said, the disciples stole the body. And you know, in a debate in Sydney, I saw William Lane Craig, who I've quoted this morning in Sydney, debating a very senior scholar at Sydney University, an atheist called Peter Slezak. And in this debate, Peter Slezak hadn't done his homework. He thought that William Lane Craig would be easy. And he said, I can think of 1,000 ways that this resurrection couldn't have happened. I mean, one idea I have right now is the disciples could have just stolen the body. And William Lane Craig said, 100 years ago, that idea was put to death and it cannot be brought up anymore because the transformation of the disciples from depressed and despairing to leaders of a new world movement must be explained. And that's all he said. He said, you can't say that in light of the scholarship anymore, period. And he showed that Peter Slezak hadn't done his reading. The disciples stole the body, one. Two, here's another one that's sometimes brought up, hallucination. The idea that the disciples, in their despair, had a hallucination of Christ resurrected and then believed it and wrote about it, and the legend grew. Well, clinical psychologist Gary Collins writes this, and this is very, very clever. He simply writes, this is very good, he writes, hallucinations are individual occurrences. By their very nature, only one person can see a given hallucination at a time. They certainly aren't something which can be seen by a group of people. It's a good way to put that to rest in two sentences. And one, I'll say one final alternative explanation, and this one is actually offered commonly today by atheistic New Testament scholars. And again, a lot of New Testament scholars at the conferences I go to and Old Testament scholars aren't Christian people and don't believe in the resurrection. And the theory is that Christ did die, and it wasn't an empty tomb, but the resurrection, a lot of scholars today say, was kind of a spiritual resurrection in the hearts and minds of the apostles. Such a great spiritual resurrection that they were transformed, but not on the basis of an actual historical physical resurrection of Christ. And scholars such as N.T. Wright, and a great book to read on the resurrection generally, if you want to read one, is his book, Surprised by Hope. I don't know, some of you, including Martha Greitmer, has read that. Who's read Surprised by Hope? I'm sure there's more than just Martha, Christine. It's a great book. If you're an average to good reader, that's a great book to read. It's a bit of a hard read, but it's not super hard. Surprised by Hope. And what N.T. Wright makes very, very clear is that in the first century, resurrection meant something very specific to Jews. And what it meant was ultimately the resurrection of the whole world, the renewal of all of creation. No more curse, as far as the curse is found, no more tears. And the resurrection of humanity, the resurrection of the dead, is the beginning of that. And so the idea that a Jewish person, and the apostles were all Jews, could say, Jesus has risen in my heart, and somehow count that as a resurrection, and say, the end of times has begun. Yahweh, the God of Israel, is now beginning to restore the world because it's happened in my heart, is a nonsense in terms of first century Jewish thought. That resurrection is precisely the physical, material, renewal, refreshment of this world. It's physical. It's to do with history and time and stuff and matter. So he puts it to bed. So when I was 18, 19, 20, 21, this is the stuff, I suppose, that I started to read and think about. And what shifted in my mind was this, precisely this, that the resurrection of Christ shifted from being a bunch of ideas to do with faith, a bunch of ideas to do with a religion, to be something to do with history that you can put on a timeline, history to do with a particular community of people, to do with documents, to do with the Roman Empire, to do with the meaning of words in the first century. And when I realized the historical embeddedness of the resurrection accounts, I became greatly strengthened in my faith. And I started to realize that Christianity is a historical faith that's to do with time and a God who has entered this world in time to renew it and restore it and bring healing. So I do like this quote here by Sir Edwin Clarke, a British High Court judge. And he writes this, "To me the evidence is conclusive." And I find this very interesting. He writes, "Over and over again in the High Court, I have secured the verdict on evidence not nearly so compelling. As a lawyer, I accept the gospel evidence unreservedly as a testimony of truthful men to the facts, to facts that they were able to substantiate." I love that second phrase, "over and over again in the High Court, I have secured the verdict on evidence not nearly so compelling." I want to then finish with an idea that I've thought about a lot. In the end, okay, Mark, let's just say that you've made the alternative theories, such as hallucination, sound unlikely. Let's just say that the idea of stealing the body is highly unlikely. Let's grant that. Surely, nonetheless, these alternative explanations are still more likely than the idea that God raised Christ from the dead. Dead people don't rise. Let's weigh up the probability. Let's say it's one in a million that the disciples stole the body. It's still surely going to be more likely than Christ rose from the dead. I think this is a very important point. And this is something that was significant to me as a young adult. And in the end, it comes back to presuppositions. If we don't believe in the existence of God, if that is absolutely, as a logical proposition, out of the question, then absolutely, the resurrection of Christ is impossible. But I am fascinated that 80% of Canadians, about the same figure for Australians, believe that there's a God. And if we believe that there's a God, the idea of that God entering history, obviously he did to create it in the first place, and raise his son from the dead, is a possibility. And so I'm going to just quote at length here now, just for a minute, William Lane Craig for the last time. And William Lane Craig says, this is exactly the issue. He says, I think that people who push these alternative theories would admit, yes, our theories are implausible, but they're not as improbable as the idea that this spectacular miracle occurred. However, at this point, the matter is no longer a historical issue. Instead, it's a philosophical question about whether miracles are possible. And then William Lane Craig goes on. He says, I would argue that the hypothesis that God raised Jesus from the dead is not at all improbable. In fact, based on the evidence, it's the best explanation for what happened. What is improbable is the hypothesis that Jesus rose naturally from the dead. That, I would agree, is outlandish. Any hypothesis would be more probable than saying that the corpse of Jesus spontaneously came back to life. But the hypothesis that God raised Jesus from the dead, doesn't contradict science or any known facts of experience. All it requires is the hypothesis that God exists, and I think that there are good independent reasons for believing that he does. And then Craig says, as long as the existence of God is even possible, it's possible that he acted in history by raising Jesus from the dead. Well, these are some of the things that have strengthened me in my faith, and I hope and pray that they've been significant for you this morning. We're going to stand and sing now. Let's stand.